Cuba has been facing the biggest protests in decades. Thousands of Cubans taking to the streets starting July 11th, calling out worsening conditions and the authoritarian regime in the country. Hundreds have been arrested. In a country with a longstanding communist one-party system known for cracking down on dissent. So let's get a little bit of a primer with Professor Michael Bustamante, Assistant Professor of Latin American History at Florida International University. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And this, as I said, is a primer. We'll undoubtedly leave something out. But we know that since the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power, mass protests are rare. How much significance do you attach to these?
I think they're hugely significant. You know, whether they lead to a tipping point or not is a different question. But even if they don't, nothing like this has happened in 60 years. The last time that anything remotely like this happened, you'd have to go back to the early 1990s, when in the throes of Cuba's post-Soviet crisis, there were isolated demonstrations in Havana. But what happened last week was all across the island. It didn't even start in Cuba's capital. And so it's simply unprecedented.
Yeah. And it seemed to be ground roots, just people seeing other people doing it and walking out their door. Why? We talk about worsening conditions. Remind us what they are.
You know, in a way, I think these protests are the result of a confluence of factors. On the one hand, Cuba is in the midst of its worst economic crisis in 30 years. Obviously, COVID has hit the country hard in an economic sense because the country is so reliant on tourism. Those economic grievances have fueled political grievances as well, a sense that the state is losing its claim to legitimacy among at least an important subset of the Cuban population. So all of these things, I think, are rolled into one in a way.
Well, let's skip back through history. And again, this is where we are really going to hopscotch through. But Cuba was a Spanish colony from the late 1400s until the late 1800s. Hundreds of thousands of slaves were brought in from Africa to work on sugar and coffee plantations. Cuba became a U.S. protectorate at the start of the 1900s. And that meant the U.S. could intervene in Cuban affairs. So remind us how the U.S. did.
Cuba and the United States have long had sort of a love-hate relationship. You know, Cubans have long defined their sense of who they are in relationship to their point of view as to who the United States is, whether for good or ill, whether aspiring to match a U.S. model of modernity or rejecting U.S. impositions in Cuban affairs. Mm-hmm. But if we think about the context of the Spanish-American War, which is really the Cuban War for Independence, it gets misnamed, and I think that tells you everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it ends in real disappointment for those who have been fighting for Cuban independence with a U.S. military occupation that really no one wanted.
Yeah.
And that was followed by a number of other similar interventions, direct and less direct, over the course of the early 20th century, which bred a real strong nationalist strain in Cuban political culture that obviously carries through to the revolution in the 1950s and 60s.
People should Google Teddy Roosevelt and dig deeper. But, you know, fast forward to 1933, Batista takes power in a military coup. Remind us why he was such an important figure.
Batista comes to power in the context of what was sort of Cuba's revolution before the revolution that we all know, right? The 1920s, there was a guy named Gerardo Machado who was in power, became a dictator. He was thrown out in a context of a revolution in 1933. And Batista kind of comes to the fore as really a reformist, a populist in some ways, but also an authoritarian. In the late 1930s, Batista established an alliance with Cuba's historic Communist Party, the same Communist Party that then would ally with Fidel Castro to overthrow Batista in the 1950s. So Cuba's history has lots of ups and downs and lots of, unpredictable turns in that way.
Well, and when that happened in the 50s, Batista was backed by the U.S. So in essence, the Cubans were overthrowing the U.S. as well and installing Fidel Castro, the young revolutionary who led the Cuban Revolution, takes power in 1959. Just briefly, what were his ideas that inspired people?
This is one of the biggest sources of debate among Cubans and historians. You know, what did Fidel Castro think? What did he want? But suffice it to say, I think the evidence is pretty strong that during the course of the 1950s and into their, 1959, 1960, Fidel Castro was not somebody who was openly embracing socialism. He was somebody whose ideas, whose nationalism, whose anti-imperialism, whose desire to have Cubans have more control over their destiny, and whose calls for you know, clean government and elections were very consistent with lines of reformist and nationalist political thought throughout the early 20th century, right? But it's in those crucial years, 1959 to 1960, when the Cuban Revolution becomes a hotspot of the global Cold War. And suddenly there's also a strategic imperative for Fidel Castro to possibly align with the Soviet Union against a United States government that really is doing everything it can from very early on to sort of stop the revolution in its tracks, even a more moderate version of it.
Yeah, well, that brings us to 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion, a failed attack by the CIA to push Fidel Castro from power. And then a year later, the Cuban Missile Crisis, this very frightening showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was over Soviet nuclear-armed missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles from the U.S. It was resolved after several days. But this is a turning point in U.S.-Cuba relations. Michael, paint a picture for us of Cuba under Fidel Castro.
There's not just one Cuba under Fidel Castro. You know, Fidel Castro was the head of state of Cuba for a really long time, which is not to say there were some things that were not a constant, right? By 1961, you really have a state that's becoming a one-party state. You have an economy that's really governed by predominant state control. But, you know, the 1960s do not look like the 1970s and 80s, which is a time when the Soviet Union is really kind of backing Cuba and shaping the way that economics and politics work in the country to a degree that they weren't in the 1960s. The 1990s is this period of absolute crisis following the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, leading into the early 2000s, right, when in the wake of some of the reforms that the government had to implement during that crisis, they begin to pull back once their economic situation begins to improve. So, you know, Cuba has gone through different eras. There's different revolutions, despite the claims of the Cuban government that, you know, this process is simply one thing.
And I think we should just fast forward again to 2008. Fidel dies. His brother Raul takes over as president. A decade later, 2018, Communist Party stalwart Miguel Díaz-Canel becomes president. That ends decades of Castro family rule. What's his rule been like?
You know, suffice it to say, these have been historic years in Cuba. The quote-unquote historic generation that led the revolution, the Castro brothers, first and foremost, are gone. And this is, I think, is also part of the context out of which these protests emerge, because Miguel Díaz-Canel, as much as he is a party stalwart, you know, he's somebody who doesn't have the Castro name. He doesn't have the history behind him in a way. He's not a charismatic leader to the extent that charisma, you know, mattered to the Cuban revolutionary project before that point. So he has inherited a very difficult economic situation in the country, but he also faces really real political challenges at this time of generational transition.
Yeah. Well, we should touch on 2014 as well. Former President Barack Obama began normalizing relations, lifting restrictions. As an American, you could fly directly to Cuba, opening an embassy. Americans were flocking to Cuba. Then 2017, former President Trump put the travel restrictions back, took a harder line toward the country. And many of his supporters here in the United States are Cubans who fled Cuba when Fidel Castro came in, who approved of that. But there are others who want the U.S. to have closer relations with their home country. What are President Biden's options?
Before the protests last week, I think there were signs that the Biden administration was beginning to move towards starting to unwind some of the Trump measures with a similar theory of the case that the Obama administration had, which is one that I, you know, fundamentally agree with, which is that isolation, conflict, sanctions, these have done nothing to better the lives of the Cuban people. Now you have these protests. You have voices in South Florida that include, importantly, some of the portion of the Cuban American community that, you know, 5 years ago were really supportive of Obama's efforts, now have kind of taken a different point of view because they're so frustrated with the slow pace of change in Cuba. And in light of these protests, they are starting to argue to the Biden administration, now is the last time for you to unwind any of these sanctions. Sort of, we've got them on the ropes. That strikes me as a very limited way of thinking. I don't think we know if we're at a tipping point. And there's real humanitarian suffering that's happening that's being aggravated by U.S. policy, which is not to say that it's responsible for everything that is happening in Cuba today. So I hope the Biden administration can see through that fog and really, you know, put in place a policy agenda that's in U.S. interest and supports the Cuban people most directly.
Well, as I said, this is an outline, but a pretty good one of where we are today. Michael Bustamante, Assistant Professor of Latin American History at Florida International University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.